and then with the heart. To the very end, Hoppy had been thinking. I had learnt the most important rule in winning. Keep thinking. For a moment, Hoppy stood over the unconscious body of his opponent. Then he brought his glove up in an unmistakable salute to Jack Hammersmith. He moved slowly to a neutral corner, and the referee commenced to count. At the count of 10, Jack Hammersmith still hadn't moved. Hoppy moved over to his corner, and then, turning to us, he held his arms up in victory. His legs were wobbling as Nels pushed the stool into the corner for him to sit down. In my excitement, I was jumping up and down and yelling my head off. It was the greatest moment of my life. I had hope. I had witnessed small triumph over big. I was not powerless. Big Hetty grabbed me and held me high above her head. In the bright moonlight, we must have stood out clearly. Hoppy stood up unsteadily, and grinning, he waved one glove in our direction. Jackhammer had been helped to his feet by his seconds, and was standing in the center of the ring, supported by them, as the referee called Hoppy over. Holding Hoppy's hand up in victory, he shouted,
"The good book tells the truth! Little David has done it again! The winner by a knockout in the 13th round, Kid Lewis!"
The railwaymen cheered their heads off, and the miners clapped sportingly, and people started to leave the stands. As the boxers left the ring, Jackhammer, still supported by his seconds, Gert, the waiter who took bets in the dining car on the train, entered the ring and began to settle bets. It had been a tremendous fight, and even the miners seemed happy enough and would stay for the Breifleis and Tiki Dry afterwards. It took 4 big railwaymen to get Big Hetty down from the top of the stand where we had been sitting. She had finished one half jack of brandy and was well into the next, and so was in no state to make it to the bottom on her own.
"We showed him. Our boy sure shucked the bejesus out of the big palooka. Jesus, PK, what a fight, eh? A darling boy with the heart of a lion."
Big Hetty was speaking in a soft-accented English, which came as a surprise.
"Whoops,"
she said, as she nearly missed her step, and fell heavily against 2 of her helpers, who were laughing almost fit to burst. We walked over to the ring where Gert was paying out. Big Hetty had one hand resting on my shoulder, as though I were a sort of human walking stick.
"I always speak the Irish tongue when I've had too much brandy. My darling father, God rest his soul, he used to say, 'My dear, only the Irish tongue is made smooth enough for a decent drinking man when he's had a few.' And he was right, you cannot get properly sozzled speaking the verdummed at all."
I said nothing. Hoppy must have told Big Hetty I was a roineck, but I wasn't taking any chances and my camouflage remained intact. I saw no point in letting her know there was an enemy or even a friend in her midst. At the ringside, the men were lining up to be paid. As we drew closer, Big Hetty, reverting back to Afrikaans, shouted at Gert,
"You good-for-nothing skellum! Where's my fiver?"
Speaking Afrikaans seemed to have an immediate sobering effect on her. She moved imperiously to the head of the queue, where Gert took 5 1-pound notes from his satchel and handed them down to her.
"Thank you for your business, Hetty," Gert said politely.
Big Hetty squinted up at him.
"And don't you forget our little business either, my boy. 3 cases of Crown Lager for the mess tomorrow night. Bring them early so I can put them on ice."
"You only said 2, Gert whined.
"The Afrikaner in me said 2, but it was such a good fight, the Irish in me says 3. You won big anyway. The odds were against Hoppy Groenewald winning."
"Shish! I didn't win so big. There was a last-minute rush to bet on Hoppy."
"Pig's ass! You won't eat steak till next Christmas if it isn't 3 cases for my boys."
By this time, Big Hetty seemed completely sober.
"A man might as well not make book with you around, Hetty."
Gert grinned and turned back to his other customers. Hoppy came out of the tent just as we reached it, and was immediately surrounded by railwaymen. He looked perfect except for a large piece of sticking plaster over his left eye, where Jackhammer Smith had butted him. Well, not absolutely perfect. In the light, you could see his right eye was swollen and was turning a deep purple colour. Bocky and Nels were with him. Neither could stop talking and throwing punches in the air and replaying the fight. I was too small to see Hoppy as more and more railwaymen crowded around him. Big Hetty grabbed me and lofted me into the air.
"Make way for the next contender!" I heard Hoppy shout.
Hans grabbed hold of me and carried me over the heads of the men to where he stood. Hoppy pulled me close to him and put his hand around my shoulder.
"We showed the big gorilla, eh, PK?"
"Yeah, Hoppy."
I was suddenly a bit tearful.
"Small can beat big if you have a plan."
Hoppy laughed.
"I'm telling you, man, I nearly thought the plan wasn't gonna work tonight."
"I'll never forget. First with the head and then with the heart."
I hugged him around the top of the legs. Hoppy rubbed his hand through my hair. The last time someone had done this, it was to rub shit into my head. Now it felt warm and safe. It was almost 3 hours before the train was due to leave, and most of the crowd had stayed behind to meet their wives after the fight at the Tiki Rai dance. Miners and railwaymen, as well as the passengers travelling on, all mixed together, the animosity during the fight forgotten. Only the Africans went home because they didn't have passes and wouldn't have been allowed to stay anyway. With a slice of Big Hetty's chocolate cake already in me, I could scarcely manage 2 sausages and a chop. I even left some meat on the chop, which I gave to a passing dog, who must have thought it was Christmas, because from then on she stayed with me. She was a nice old bitch, although she looked a bit worn out from having puppies, and her teats hung almost to the ground. She walked slowly, like old bitches do, and after a while I felt we'd always known each other. One ear was torn, and her left eye drooped, probably from a fight or something. She was a nice yellow colour with a brown patch on her bum. It had been a long day, and I was beginning to feel tired. I'd never been up this late when I was happy. Hoppy found me and the dog sitting against a big gum tree, nodding off. Picking me up, he carried me to the utility. I was too tired to notice if the old yellow bitch followed us. Big Hetty was sitting in the back of the truck, her huge body almost filling it. She had a fresh half-jack and was using it to conduct herself in song.
"When Irish eyes are smiling, sure it's like the morning breeze."
I was amazed at her raucous sound. I had never before encountered a woman who couldn't sing.
"Shh! Hetty, the next contender, wants to sleep," Hoppy said.
Big Hetty stopped, the brandy bottle poised mid-stroke.
"Me darling boy, come and give Hetty a big kiss."
It was the last thing I remember. Big Hetty was speaking Irish again. I guess she must have gone back to being drunk. 7. I woke at dawn to the by now familiar lickety-clack of the carriage wheels. From the colour of the light coming through the compartment window, I could see it was the time Grandpa Chook would come to the dormitory window and crow his silly old neck off. I suppose he had conditioned me to waking at first light. The light which fled past the compartment window was still soft with a greyish tint. Soon the sun would come and polish it till it shone. The landscape had changed in a subtle way. Yesterday's rolling grassland was now broken by an occasional kopje, rocky outcrops with clumps of dark green bush, each no more than 100 feet high. Flat-topped fever trees were more frequent, and in the far distance a sharp line of mountains brushed the horizon in a wet watercolour purple. We were coming into the true Lowveld. I sat up and became aware of a note pinned to the front of my shirt. I undid the safety pin to find a piece of paper with a 10-shilling note attached to it. I was a bit stunned. I'd never handled a banknote, and it was difficult to imagine it belonged to me. If one sucker cost a penny, I could buy 120 suckers with this 10 shillings. On the piece of paper was a carefully printed note from Hoppy.
"Dear PK, here is the money you won. We sure showed that big gorilla who was the boss. Small can beat big. But remember, you have to have a plan. Like when I hit Jackhammer Smith the knockout punch when he thought I was down for the count. Remember always, first with the head and then with the heart. Without both, I'm telling you, plans are useless. Remember, you are the next contender. Good luck, little booty."
Your friend in boxing and always. Hoppy Groenewald. P.S. Say always to yourself, first with the head and then with the heart. That's how a man stays ahead from the start. H.G. I was distressed at having left the best friend after Grandpa Chook and Nanny that I had ever had, without so much as a goodbye. Hoppy had passed briefly through my life, like a train passing in the night. I had known him a little over 24 hours, yet he had managed to change my life. He had given me the power of one. One idea, one heart, one mind, one plan, one determination. Hoppy had sensed my need to grow, my need to be assured that the world around me had not been specially arranged to bring about my undoing. He gave me a defense system, and with it he gave me hope. In the early morning, the lickety-clack of the carriage wheel sounded sharper and louder, as though racing towards the light. It was only by concentrating hard that I could hear the cadence of someone breathing. First an inhalation, deep and mournful, then complete silence for a few moments, and then a powerful whistling sound as a great volume of air was exhaled. At first I thought it might be part of the train. After all, I was not much of an expert on trains. But then I began to suspect that the whistling sound had something to do with the smell in the compartment. It was so severe, I had to cover my nose with my sheet. Holding my nose, I peered over the edge of the bunk. In the bunk below me lay Big Hetty, still fully dressed. She was heaving in her sleep like a beached sperm whale. With every intake of air, her bosom and stomach rose almost to touch the bottom of my bunk. Wow, kapow, what a stink! Her arm was stretched out with her hand planted firmly on the carpet, acting as a prop to prevent her from tumbling to the floor. On the bunk directly opposite her was a smallish suitcase and a very large square wicker picnic hamper. Big Hetty and I had the compartment to ourselves, which was just as well, as Big Hetty's brandy breath filled it, and I knew that if I remained in my bunk, I was done for. I moved to the bottom of my bunk and managed to push the compartment window down. Sitting as close to the window as possible, I gulped at the fresh air flying past. Then, withdrawing my head when my nose was almost frozen, I removed the duck from my pocket, and carefully folding Hoppy's note and the 10-shilling banknote together, I tied them into the corner with Grandpa's shilling. Then I pinned the duck back into my pocket, feeling dangerously rich. Dangling from my bunk, I managed to swing clear of Big Hetty's body, to land with a soft thud on the floor. My heart beat wildly at the thought of waking her up, but it soon became apparent that she was pretty fast asleep. The door to the compartment was open just a crack, and using both hands I slid it open just enough to squeeze through into the corridor. The corridor window almost directly opposite was half open, and by standing on my toes, I could get my nose into the fresh air. I stood there, watching the early morning folding back. It can be very cold in the low veld before the sun rises, and without a blanket I soon began to shiver. I tried to ignore the cold, concentrating on the lickety-clack of the carriage wheels. I became aware that the lickety-clack was talking to me. Mix the head with the heart, you're ahead from the start. Mix the head with the heart, you're ahead from the start, the wheels chanted, until my head began to pound with the rhythm. It was becoming the plan I would follow for the remainder of my life. It was to become the secret ingredient in the power of one. It grew too cold to stand there in the corridor with the window open, so I made my way down to the end of the carriage and sat on the lavatory with the door closed. Then I felt like having a piss, and I did that and pulled a lever at the side of the toilet, and a trapdoor at the bottom of the toilet bowl opened directly onto the tracks. The noise of the wheels rose up at me, and you could see a blur of gravel and a flash of sleepers as the train whizzed over them. I stood there with my hand on the lever. Since the episode with the judge, I had thought a bit about shit. At the hostel we did it in tins, which would be taken away every week, and empty ones that smelt of disinfectant put in their place. I often wondered where they took all the stuff. At least now I knew what the railways did with theirs. It grew too cold even in the lavatory, and so I made my way back to the compartment. As I slid back the door, I saw that a calamity had befallen Big Hetty. The arm that had propped her up all night had finally collapsed, and she lay with the top half of her massive body on the floor, while her legs remained on the bunk. The skirt of her dress had ridden up to cover her face. With each intake of breath, It was sucked tightly against her face, and with every exhalation it billowed out like the collar on a frill-necked lizard. Her huge legs, bluish-white and laced with varicose veins, stuck out of an enormous pair of shiny pink bloomers, the elastic ends of which reached down to just above her knees. She appeared to be carrying most of her weight on her neck and shoulders, and I observed that her face was growing increasingly flushed, and tiny bubbles were forming at the corners of her mouth. I tried to wake her by shaking her as hard as I could.
"Wake up, Mfro Hetty," I begged.
But she just grunted and inhaled, was silent and exhaled with a whistle of stale air and a short snort which brought on the bubbles. I soon realized that she couldn't remain half in and half out of the bunk in such a topsy-turvy position, but lifting her back onto it was plainly beyond me. I climbed over her body and onto her bunk. Using all my strength and by propping my legs against the walls of the compartment, I managed to push both her legs off the bunk so that they landed on the compartment floor with a great plop I was sure would wake her. Her huge body now filled every inch of floor space between the bunks as neatly as if she had been canned in a sardine factory in Portugal, but she did not wake. The bright red colour soon left her face, and while she continued to whistle, she did not snort, which I took as a good sign. Soon even the bubbles stopped. I climbed onto her tummy and managed to pull a blanket off her bunk. I pulled her dress down and covered her with the blanket, and with some difficulty managed to get a cushion under her head. She gave a soft sigh and then let go a huge burp, which was damn nearly the end of me. Boy, did she stink! The blanket wasn't big enough to cover her entirely. It fell like a small blue tent, covering her bosom and tummy and reaching to the top of her legs. The big Hetty tent was pitched right in the middle of the compartment, inhaling and exhaling and whistling away. I wrapped myself in the remaining blanket and sat with my nose at the open compartment window. There was simply nothing else I could think to do. The sun was coming up over the distant Lebombo Mountains, and the African felt sparkled as though it were contained in a crystal goblet. There was a sudden rattle at the door and a single sharp word, "Conductor!" Whereupon the door slid open to reveal a slight man in a navy serge uniform, just like Hoppy's. Only this man looked very neat, and his boots shone like a mirror. Around the edge of the elliptical blue and white enamel badge on his cap, it read, "South African Railways, Suid-Afrikaanse Spoorweë." But unlike Hoppy's, which had the word "guard" written across the centre, this badge read "conductor." I don't suppose it is important to know what a badge says, but when you're small and on your own, you've got to gather all the information you can as fast as you can. Good camouflage depends on this. The man at the compartment door wore a thin black moustache, which looked as though it had been drawn on with a screw crayon. His bleak expression suggested someone already soured by the burdens of life. He looked down at the big Hetty tent with her head only inches from his polished boots.
"What's going on here, man?" he demanded.
"Mfro Hetty fell off the bunk, meneer,"
I answered in a frightened voice.
"Why me? Why always me? Why always Peakwater? Why not somebody else? What have I ever done to anyone?"
He looked directly at me.
"Does she belong to you?" he asked in an accusing voice.
Before I was able to reply, he put a finger and thumb to his furrowed brow and with a wince corrected himself.
"No, of course not. That is Big Hetty."
He gasped as the realization hit him fully.
"My God! Big Hetty is on my train!"
He sounded as if he were about to cry.
"What am I going to do, man?"
he wailed.
I don't know, Mynheer. She was just here when I woke up."
Peakwater sniffed, jerking his head back.
"Well, I'm telling you now, man, she can't stay like this."
He looked down in distaste at the slumbering woman, then stuck his hand into the compartment, leaning slightly over Big Hetty.
"Where's your ticket? Give it here, boy," he said.
"I have it here, Mynheer."
I hurriedly fumbled with the safety pin where Hoppy had pinned my ticket to the clean shirt I had changed into for the fight.
"Bring it here, man. I can't climb over this dead cow to get it."
I crawled along the bank, and by stretching out my arm as far as I could, managed to reach his hand.
"This ticket is not clipped," he said accusingly. "You got on this train who knows where. I'm not a mind reader. This ticket is not clipped, man."
"I didn't know I had to give it to be clipped, Mynheer," I said, suddenly fearful.
"It's that verdomde Hoppy Groenewald.
He did this on purpose to make work for me. Not clipping tickets is an offence. Just because he's going into the army, he thinks he can go around not clipping tickets. Who does he think he is, man? What do you think would happen if we all went around not clipping tickets?
Please, Meneer, Hoppy clipped everybody's ticket. He only forgot mine. That's the honest truth, honest.
I pleaded, frantic that Hoppy would get into trouble on my behalf.
Hmph. It wouldn't surprise me to find that that one lets dirty kaffirs ride for nothing and then does bad things to their women. He's not a married man, you know. First I lose £1.10 betting on that big ape from the mines, and now that one who calls himself after a nigger boxer goes around not clipping people's tickets.
He paused and cleared his throat.
I'm afraid it is my duty to report this, he said,
his lips drawn thinly so that his crayon moustache stretched in a dead straight line across his upper lip.
Please, Meneer, he hates kaffirs just like you. Please don't report him.
That's all right for you. You're his friend. You'll say anything.
He paused as though thinking.
All right, I'm a fair man. You can ask anybody about that, but mark my word. Next time that Hoppy Grunewald is going to be in a lot of trouble, or my name is not Pick Porter.
He withdrew a pair of clippers from his waistcoat pocket and clipped my ticket.
Thank you, Meneer Porter. You're a very kind man.
To God for my own good, boy. If you help others, all you get is a kick in the face. But I am a born-again Christian and not a vengeful type. The Bible says, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. But sometimes I'm telling you, he nudged Big Hetty with the toe of his shiny boot, the cross the Lord expects me to carry is very heavy, man.
He gave Big Hetty several more quick nudges with his boot.
Wake up, you old cow. This compartment is the property of the South African Railways, and it says in the rules no passenger shall decamp on the floor of the carriages. Wake up! You're officially breaking the rules lying there like a dead cow.
Snort, sigh. Breathe in, silence. Breathe out, whistle, snort, was all he got back.
Come, boy, I will take you to breakfast. Your ticket says you get breakfast.
Breakfast was another feast of bacon and eggs with toast, jam and coffee. It was too early for the other passengers, and a waiter called Henny Fenter served us. He was pleased as punch with himself because he had won £5 on the fight. Forgetting what he had said to me about losing £1.10, Peak Porter proceeded to give him a long lecture on the sin of fighting and the even greater evil of gambling. He ended by asking Henny if he was ashamed and ready to repent. Henny put down a plate of fresh toast, covered with a linen napkin to keep it warm. No, Meneer Porter, gambling is only a sin if you lose, because you didn't back your own kind, but bet on the other side. He lifted the silver coffee pot and commenced to fill the conductor's cup.
Hm, he's only a grade two railwayman, and look how cheeky he is already. Young people don't know their place anymore. Bring more coffee, man! Can't you see this pot is cold?
Pick Porter cried. We returned to the compartment to find Big Hetty still whistling and snorting away. Pick Porter, a little mellowed from breakfast, did not prod her with the toe of his shining boot.
She's not a true Afrikaner, you know. Her father was an Irishman who was too fond of the bottle. Drink is a sin that is passed on. The Bible says the sins of the father shall be passed unto the third and fourth generation.
Now he gave Big Hetty a nudge.
Here lies a good example of God's terrible vengeance.
Balls!
Big Hetty said suddenly, opening one eye and looking backwards up at us.
Peak's arse! You're a miserable Bible-bashing, two-faced bastard, Peak Porter. You probably already had a good look up my dress, eh? Get me up, you self-righteous little shit. Get me up at once.
I did not. How could I? A person would have to climb over you to get such a look, and you also have a blanket over you.
Pick Porter whined.
Mother of Jesus, my head hurts. I must have water. My mouth tastes like the splashboard of an Indian lavatory in the mango season.
Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain,
Pick Porter spluttered. Big Hetty ignored him.
Oh, I must have a glass of water, PK, or I shall die. I'll have to climb over you, Mevrouw Hetty. The glass and the wash basin on the other side. Climb over, darling. Take also the blanket off me. Ah, I'm burning up.
I climbed over Big Hetty, and when I got to the empty bunk, I pulled the blanket off her. Crawling to the end of the bunk, I removed a glass from the chrome metal loop where it rested on the wall, and lifting the lid off the washbasin, I half-filled the glass with water. I had to sit on Hetty's chest to give it to her, and she drank greedily. She had 3 half glasses full before she'd had enough.
"Thank you, darling," she smiled. "You've saved my life for sure."
"The wages of sin is death," Peake Porter spat out.
Half turning her head towards him, Big Hetty said,
"Oh, my God, to think I may die on the floor of a second-class compartment of the South African Railways, under the incompetent management of that snivelling asshole, Peake Porter."
She paused for a moment.
"Who, by the way, calls himself a man and then bets against his fellow railwaymen in boxing matches?"
"That's a free world. How was I to know that big ape had a glass jaw?"
he protested in his whining voice.
"Glass jaw? What do you mean, glass jaw? Glass jaw, my horse? Hoppy Grunewald knocked him out fair and square."
Big Hetty's face had turned purple with indignation, and her head bobbed up and down on the pillow.
"Oh, oh, my head. Get me a wet towel, PK. I think it's going to explode."
I scrambled over to the basin, and removing the hand towel from where it was hanging at the side of the basin, I rinsed it in cold water.
"Wring it out well, you hear?" Peake Porter shouted. "I can't have wet towels. These towels are the property of South African Railways, and you're supposed to use them for drying yourself, not for wetting yourself."
"Ja, meneer Porter," I replied.
I was suddenly grateful for the judge's iron bar torture, because I was able to wring the small towel out quite well. I sat on Hetty's chest, and folding the wet towel to the right size, I laid it across her forehead.
"Dankie, Liefling," she said.
She half turned her head again to Peake Porter.
"So, have you thought of a plan to get me up, Domkop?"
"Please do not talk to me like this, Hetty. I'm a grade one conductor with 17 years service in the railways. This whole train is under my command, and all the people in it must do as I say. I demand more respect."
Peake Porter seemed on the verge of tears.
"I will have to get first inside the compartment, and that is impossible without climbing over you."
"We'll take off your boots first."
Peake Porter crouched down in the corridor and began to untie the laces of his boots. From where I sat, I could see him pull off his boots and line them up against the outside wall of the compartment, toes pointing into the corridor. He stretched his leg over Big Hetty's body in an attempt to reach the bunk without having to climb over her. His toes inside a well-darned black sock were wiggling like a pig's snout, trying to find the edge of the bunk. A larger man with longer legs might have made it, but Peake Porter's exploring big toe was well short of its mark.
"It's not possible, Hetty," he said mournfully.
"Do it backwards, stupid. Come in backwards with your legs first."
With his hands flat on the corridor floor, Peake Porter edged into the compartment backwards. He placed one foot on one of Big Hetty's breasts, then he followed with the other. He inched his way over her belly until he was obliged to put both his hands on her shoulders, his head only inches from her face. Big Hetty suddenly let go an enormous burp. The blast of foul air took all the strength out of Peake Porter's arms, and he collapsed into the mountain of flesh below him. Big Hetty let out a gasp.
"Oh, excuse me," she said.
Then she began to giggle, wobbling like a jelly mountain.
"Oh, Christ! Oh, Jesus! Lord have mercy! Are you trying to love me? Or help me? Either way, you're doing a terrible job!"
Big Hetty gave 2 more snorts and her head fell back onto the pillow, exhausted.
"Oh, I'm dying,"
she moaned, and lifting the arm that pinned Peake Porter down, she wiped away her tears. Sensing freedom, Peake Porter pushed off Big Hetty's shoulders with both hands and raised his torso. He managed to get his hands around the raised edge of the bunk on either side of Big Hetty and inserted one foot between Big Hetty's calves, while the other foot rested on the edge of the bunk. Panting furiously, he raised himself to a standing position.
"God will punish you for this! He who plucks one hair from the head of a child of mine, it is as though he doeth this to me, thus saith the Lord.
Pick Porter was shaking his finger at Big Hetty and panting away like the old yellow bitch I had met the previous night.
"Keep your preaching for the next prayer meeting at the Apostolic Faith Mission, you miserable little shithouse. Here, give me your hand."
Big Hetty stretched her arm out, offering her hand to Pick Porter. He shied away in alarm.
"Grab it, damn it, man!" "No damn fear. You'll only pull me back again,"
Pick Porter said in terror.
"Do not flatter yourself, man. Use both hands. I can't stay like this all day unless you can cut a hole in the floor,"
she threatened. That was enough to spur him into action. He grabbed Big Hetty round the wrist with both hands, while she grabbed onto his arm with her own hand. Grimacing with the effort, he started to pull. Big Hetty's freed shoulder wobbled a little in response, but no other part moved.
"Pull, man!"
she shouted. But soon it was obvious that nothing was going to happen.
"Give Tarzan here a hand, PK. Show him what the real man can do," she said in some despair.
There wasn't any space to stand, so I sat astride Big Hetty's hips, my feet not quite reaching the edge of the bunk on either side. The idea was to get Big Hetty's torso into an upright position, which might then enable us to get under her arms from the back to lift her up. I grabbed her around the wrists with both hands, which failed to meet, but nevertheless gave me quite a good grip. Pick Porter was forced to bend over so that he could grab Big Hetty higher up her arm.
"Now, get your backs into it, men. I'm going to count to three. On three, give it all you've got, you hear? 1, 2, 3!
We both pulled with all our might. After about 5 minutes of repeating such efforts, she hadn't budged an inch.
"Oh, it's no use," Pick Porter gasped.
We were all beginning to realize that we were in a real pickle. The effort to cooperate had cost Big Hetty dearly, and she lay there panting in a lather of sweat, her face as red as an old turkey cock's. Pick Porter stood with one foot still balanced on the edge of the bunk, and the other inserted between Big Hetty's calves, wiping his sweaty hands on the shiny backside of his navy serge pants. He had taken off his jacket and thrown it on the top bunk. On his silver tie clip, "Witnessing for the Lord" was written. I wondered briefly what it meant.
"One last try. Just one more go. This time it will work for sure,"
Big Hetty panted, her voice not sounding too hopeful. She made me clasp my hands together, and she then grabbed me around both wrists, thus allowing Pick Porter to get a better two-handed grip around her wrists. He had also managed to get his bum up against the wash basin, which gave him a much better pulling purchase.
1, 2, 3. Pull,
Big Hetty commanded. We both pulled like mad, Pick Porter grunting with effort behind me. Big Hetty's way of holding me wasn't such a good idea. Her hands were wet with perspiration, and I could feel my own hands beginning to slip from her grasp. Suddenly they squeezed out like a wet pumpkin pip, and I was catapulted violently backwards, the back of my head slamming hard into Pick Porter's crotch. He gave a loud scream, and both his hands shot down between his legs. Despite her discomfort, Big Hetty let out a scream of delight.
"You've neckered him, boy!" she roared. "You've taken what was left of his manhood!"
Her laughter filled the compartment, causing her great body to shake up and down.
"Coffee, coffee, early morning coffee!"
It was Henny Fenter, the waiter from breakfast, doing the morning wake-up call. He paused at the open door of our compartment.
"Coffee?"
he asked, starting to bring the tray down from his shoulder. His eyes widened in disbelief as he observed Big Hetty pumping up and down with laughter and Pick Porter moaning and clutching his genitals. He only just managed to lower the tray to the corridor floor before he burst into laughter.
"Pick Porter, you dirty old bastard! Sussman, the door's not even closed!"
The sudden appearance of the waiter seemed to bring Big Hetty around.
"Henny Fenter, not a moment too soon," she declared.
Henny, convulsed with laughter, appeared not to hear her.
"A cup of coffee, mevrouw?"
he asked, and then burst into renewed laughter. They calmed down, and with some difficulty Henny Fenter managed to pull the still groaning Pick Porter over Big Hetty's body and through the compartment door. He stood in the corridor almost doubled up, his face as white as a ghost. He winced, sucking the air through his brown teeth, as he bent down further to recover his boots. I bundled up his coat and threw it over to Henny Fenter, who draped it over the hapless Pick Porter's shoulder. With one hand carrying his boots and the other clutching his waterworks, he hobbled away down the corridor towards the guard's van. Henny Fenter turned out to be the practical sort. He made me fetch a second pillow, which he added to the first one, to prop Big Hetty's head up as far as she could go. He even managed to get her to drink a cup of coffee by herself. He inspected the situation carefully, and then announced that there was no way of lifting Big Hetty without first removing the lower bunks.
"Sorry, Hetty," he said, shaking his head. "We're going to have to wait until we get the carp maiden."
He started to pour Hetty another cup of coffee.
"No damn fear," she said quickly. "Unless you want to cut a bloody hole in the floor."
Henny Fenter scratched his head, giving Big Hetty a quizzical look.
"What the hell are you doing on this train, anyway?"
Big Hetty half turned to look backwards and up at him, her mouth in a pout of annoyance.
"Do you think for one moment that I would let this poor child travel all the way to Carp Murden on his own?" she asked.
Henny Fenter persisted.
"You were also a little drunk, maybe?"
"Pissed as a newt, drunk as a skunk," she giggled. "What a fight it was, eh, Henny?"
"You can say that again, Hetty," Henny said happily. "I won 2 weeks' wages with a 10-bob bet. Machtig! What a fighter that Hoppy Grunewald is, a real white man."
Big Hetty looked up at me sheepishly.
"I came to look after you, PK."
She grinned suddenly.
"Anyway, man, let's make the most of a bad situation, eh? I always say, if you can't change things, then you have to make sure you're riding on the front elephant and not walking with the poor people at the back. It's time for breakfast, and I must say I'm starving."
She looked back at Henny Fenter.
"Off you go, you skellum. 6 sausages, 6 rashers of bacon, nice and crisp, mind. 5 hard-boiled eggs to constipate me, and 1/2 loaf of toast cut thick with lots of butter. No more coffee. You know what coffee does to a person. I'm going to have to cross my legs as it is. For PK, the same, only 1/2.
"Near, near, Mevrouw Hetty. I have already had breakfast," I protested.
"Nonsense, child. You are no bigger than a sparrow. What will your mamma say if I hand you over like this? We must feed you up, and that's all there is to it."
Henny Fenter left us to fetch breakfast, and I imagined Big Hetty feeding me up in the next 8 hours so that I arrived in Barberton as big, if not bigger, than the judge. There my grandpa would be, looking around for a real skinny kid to get off the train, and there I'd be, big as the judge. What a nasty shock he would get.
"I already ate a whole plate of things, Mevrouw Hetty," I said again. "Never mind, PK. A little more never hurt. You've got to be like the bushmen in the Kalahari Desert. They eat as much as they can get in the good times till their bottoms stick out like their stomachs. Then, when the bad times come, they live off their own fat."
She chuckled softly.
"I reckon a person like me could go a whole year, or even more, living off their own fat. But you, my poor little blossom, I doubt if you'll get to Carp Murden."
Henny Fenter returned with a large tray of food, which he carefully balanced on Big Hetty's stomach. He left us to serve breakfast to the other passengers in the dining car, closing the door behind him and promising to return later. The tray went up and down as Big Hetty breathed. She could only see what to take from a plate on a down breath, for on an up breath the tray raised above her eye level. I managed to eat 1 more sausage. Big Hetty didn't seem to notice and polished off my breakfast as well. Though when she finished, she said,
"You'll never get to play rugby for the Springboks if you eat like a bird, PK." "That's okay, Mevrouw Hetty," I answered. "I'm going to be a welterweight, which is not so big."
She seemed amused.
"Just like that good-for-nothing Hoppy Grunewald, huh? Well, you could do worse, I suppose. Not a bad bone in his body, that one. He could have made it big time, but he doesn't hate. Not even Kaffirs, which isn't natural."
I was shocked. Hoppy hadn't said anything to me about the necessity of hate. Was this something he had neglected to tell me?
"How do you learn to hate, Mevrouw Hetty?"
I was fearful that it might prove to be something beyond the abilities of a 5, really 6-year-old. Perhaps that's why Hoppy hadn't mentioned this hate business. But hadn't he said I was a natural? If I was a natural, then I would be able to learn it for sure.
The killer instinct. He hasn't got the killer instinct. You can tell when a fighter's got it. It's proper hate. Like the Boere hate the Roynecks. It has to be blind hate like that. Them or us. Him or me. Nothing less. Hoppy Groenewald just never learned to hate.
Then I will learn to hate also, I said with conviction. Big Hetty rocked with laughter.
Plenty of time for that, Piquet. Better still to concentrate on love. There is already too much hate in this land of ours. This country has been starved of love too long.
I wasn't listening. My mind was busy with the need to learn to hate.
Didn't Hoppy hate Jack Hammersmith?
That was pride. Hoppy has plenty of that, and courage and even brains.
Big Hetty suddenly sensed my anxiety.
Look here, man. Maybe that's enough.
She chuckled softly.
He sure outfoxed that big ape Smith.
I cast my mind back to when I had done the judge's homework, just like that. I had no doubt I had brains. But during the torture sessions I hadn't shown any pride, and precious little courage. But I had to admit to myself I wasn't at all sure what pride meant. Maybe I was fatally flawed. Only brains and nothing to go with them.
How do you learn to have pride and courage, Mevrouw Hetty?
My goodness me, we are full of questions, Piquet. Now let me see.
She thought for a few moments and then replied.
Pride is holding your head up when everyone around you has theirs bowed. Courage is what makes you do it.
She looked up to see the confusion on my face.
Never mind, Piquet. The understanding will come suddenly when you need it.
I wasn't at all sure about that. Big Hetty's advice seemed downright stupid to me. I already knew that camouflage was the only way, that bowing your head with the rest was the best way to survive. Take the incident with Miss Duplessis. Hadn't I raised my head then, and she damn near cut it off? And Grandpa Chook, if he hadn't shat in the judge's mouth, we'd still be together. There were no two ways about it. When you stood out in the crowd, trouble was sure to follow. Maybe there was something more to understand. The world of grown-ups seemed very complicated. I was good at remembering things, so I tucked Big Hetty's words away. Someday they might make sense. Nanny was the only grown-up I knew who answered questions properly. And she wasn't really a grown-up because she was a nanny. When you asked her a thing, she would answer with a story or a song. And when she hadn't an answer, she would say,
"That is a matter for later finding out."
She was always right. Sooner or later, the answer would come from somewhere. It seemed to me that white people grown-ups always had to have an answer on the spot. Like Pick Porter, they lived most of their lives being miserable and asking, "Why me?" all the time. Nanny would say,
"Sadness has a season and will pass."
Then she would laugh and hug me and say,
"But it isn't the season for sadness yet."
I kept wetting the towel for Big Hetty and got her 2 Aspirin from her handbag. She told me to scrounge around because she might have some peppermints in there. I found 1/2 packet and she said,
"Give me a couple and try one yourself, PK."
I took 2 round white peppermints out of the pack and put them in her hand and popped 1/3 into my mouth. At first, nothing. Then, pow, I lasted about 2 good sucks and then spat the peppermint into my hand. It was like swallowing fire. I watched Big Hetty suck away happily. Talk about courage. But I must say those peppermints cleaned up her breath a treat. Big Hetty and I just lay there, she on the floor and me on the bunk. She talked about her life, which seemed to have been quite a good one, but with some sadness also. Mostly she talked about men.
"Men, Piquet, are a good woman's downfall. Most of them are rotten, but you've got to have them anyway. Without a man, a woman's life is more rotten than with one. It's no use pretending you don't care, that you're stronger than a man, because even if it is true, it means nothing except loneliness. Men are pigs who sleep with Kaffir women and get
drunk and beat you up, but a good beating never hurt. And sometimes it's the only way those stupid men can show you they love you. It's stupid, eh? I tried to imagine a man beating up Big Hetty.
My grandpa couldn't beat up a flea, I said,
trying to comfort her. Big Hetty stood 6'7" and weighed nobody knows how much. Even the judge, with all his stormtroopers, couldn't get the better of her.
Once I loved this little flyweight, she continued. That's how I learnt about boxing, PK. It was during the Great Depression, and you couldn't find work nowhere, man. Me and that little flyweight, we used to travel all over the Transvaal, and once to the Orange Free State to fight. There was never another flyweight to fight. The Boer liked to see the bigger men, and so he always had to fight way out of his division. A middleweight, usually. If he was lucky, he'd get a welterweight. But it didn't happen very often. That little flyweight of mine was game, and he loved to fight, but you can't give away that much weight. And he used to take some terrible poundings, and nearly always lost. Afterwards I'd patch him up and he'd make me talk to him about the fight, blow by blow, where he was good and where he went wrong. I'd tell him how he was always winning, which was true. He'd be a mile ahead on points, and then the big ape he was fighting would catch him a lucky shot and put him away. And he used to look at me and say, "Next time, Hetty, you'll see, I'll win for sure." And then we would buy a bottle of cheap brandy and drive out of the town we were in and sit in the back of the Model T and get drunk. When he was drunk, it was his turn to replay the fight, only he'd get it all mixed up in his head. And he'd think he was still in the fight, and I was his opponent, and he'd beat the shit out of me. And I always let him, because he had to have some wins for his pride. Then when I'd taken a beating and he had counted me out, we would drink some more and replay the fight again, which this time he won fair and square. We would then find some nice place behind some bushes and take our blankets and make love. I'm telling you, PK, most men can't get it up when they're drunk, but not my flyweight. He could go all night. What a man he was. They were good times. Oh, oh, such good times.
Big Hetty's story worried me no end. Here it seemed Big always beat small, except in a setup.
Hoppy was smaller than Jack Hammersmith, and he beat him fair and square,
I said, somewhat defensively.
Yeah, that is true. Hoppy has brains. My flyweight had mashed potato for brains. But I loved that little flea bite until the day he died from taking on one big ape too many.
Big Hetty's eyes welled with tears.
He was coming out for the sixth round when he staggered and fell. The crowd booed and booed, but he never faked anything in his life, and I knew something terrible had happened. He had a brain hemorrhage, just like that. I carried him out of the hall in my arms, and we sat on the grass outside in the fresh air with lots of stupid people in a circle looking down at us. But I didn't see any of them, just my darling little flyweight. And then he died, right there in my arms.
Big Hetty was sobbing softly.
Don't cry, Mevrouw Hetty, please don't cry.
I quoted Nanny.
Sadness has a season and will pass.
She stopped sobbing after a while and dabbed at her eyes with the damp towel.
He was the best. The very best of men.
She said it so softly I knew she was speaking to herself. We talked about this and that deep into the hot morning. Big Hetty did most of the chatting, as I had developed into a listener. Once I had been a regular chatterbox, but school had changed all that. A person of my status was not expected to talk much, and besides, listening is a good camouflage. I soon discovered that it is also an art. You learn not simply to listen to what people say, it's what people don't say that is important. If you listen hard enough, you can hear the most amazing things going on behind the speaker's voice. Quite often there is a regular conniption going on. It takes years to make a good translation of this secondary soundtrack, and as a small child, I could only define it as friendly or otherwise. For camouflage reasons, this is often sufficient. Around noon, Hetty dozed off. This time her breathing was much better. Outside the compartment window, the bush felt baked in the hot sun. The sunlight flattened the country in the foreground, and smudge the horizon in a haze of heat. It is a time when the cicadas become so active that they fill the flat, hot space with a sound so constant it sings like silence in the brain. While I couldn't hear them for the clickety-clack of the carriage wheels, I knew they were out there, brushing the heat into their green-membraned wings, energizing after the long sleep when their pupae lay buried in the dark earth, sometimes for years, until a conjunction of the moon and the right soil temperature creates the moment to emerge and once again fill the noon space. In the heat, the compartment seemed to float, lifting off the silver rails and moving through time and space. Through hours and days and weeks and years, off the blue planet, past the moon and the sun, into centuries and millenniums and eons, skirting planets, weaving through the stars, coming finally to a black hole in space, further even than the mind can think, beyond even the curve of infinity and the silver cord which rings the cosmos. There I would remain, safely hidden, until I could grow up to be welterweight champion of the world.
Are you asleep, Piquet?
I opened my eyes to see Big Hetty looking at me.
A glass of water, if you please.
She ran her tongue over her dry lips and removed the towel from her forehead. She handed me the towel and I gave her the glass of water, which she gulped greedily. She handed the glass back and I refilled it.
Ah, you're one in a thousand, Piquet,
she said gratefully. I wet the towel, folded it, and placed it over her head.
One in maybe even a million, she sighed.
I could see she was restless and kept licking her lips.
What's for lunch, do you think?
Meneer Fenter hasn't been yet, Mevrouw Hetty, I answered.
Ach, man, I didn't mean that lunch. A person can't eat a train lunch. Breakfast is tolerable, lunch unbearable, and dinner unthinkable. Open up my hamper, Piquet, and let a person hear what is inside.
She laughed.
I'll tell you something. I wasn't concentrating too well when I packed it last night.
I withdrew the slim bamboo rod threaded through the wicker and opened the large basket. Inside was enough food to feed an army.
Tell me what we got in there, darling,
Big Hetty said anxiously.
2 roasted chickens, nearly a full leg of mutton, some corned beef, 3 mangoes, lots of cold potatoes and sweet potatoes too, 2 oranges, and there's also a big tin.
Oh, thank the Lord I brought the tin, Big Hetty said with obvious relief. Open it, Piquet, quick man, open the tin.
I was surprised at the urgency in her voice. I lifted the large round tin out of the hamper and, clamping it between my knees, struggled to remove the lid. It came away suddenly, sending me sprawling backwards on the bunk, and the tin slid over the edge of the bunk, spilling half of a large chocolate cake onto Big Hetty's stomach. In 2 swift movements, her arm rose and fell, the edge of her hand sliced through the thick layer of deep brown chocolate icing, rending the cake into 2 large pieces. She had started to pant, and her eyes were glazed as she crammed her mouth full of cake. She grunted and snorted and even moaned as she demolished the first hunk and then reached greedily for the second. Her face was covered with chocolate icing. Stuffing the last bits into her mouth, she sucked at her fingers as a small child might, 2 at a time. Then she plopped her thumb in and out of her mouth several times and ran her hand across her bosom, her fingers moving like a fat spider hunting for any cake she might have missed. She looked up at me and I dropped my gaze, ashamed and frightened. But at the same time, I instinctively knew I was watching a sickness or a sadness, or even both. When she had finished, Big Hetty was in a lather of sweat, the front of her dress soaked in perspiration, covered with cake crumbs and stained with chocolate icing. She used the damp towel to wipe her face and then lay there panting heavily, her eyes closed. I watched as tears ran down the side of her face, but she said nothing for a long while. When she had recovered her breath, she opened her eyes, which were red and looked puffy.
"I'm sorry, Piquet. I'm very, very sorry," she said, her voice almost a whisper.
"It is nothing, Mevrouw Hetty. It was only that you were hungry. Chocolate cake makes me feel like that all the time."
"I'm sorry I ate all the cake, Piquet. But now you get first pick of everything."
It had been a long time since I'd been given first pick of anything, and I laughed.
"There's enough of the whole train in here, Mevrouw Hetty. I will have cold roast potatoes, after that sweet potatoes. They are my two favourites." "And maybe a nice piece of chicken, eh?"
Grandpa Chook's death was still much too close to me. The prospect of eating one of his distant relatives, even if this chicken hadn't been a proper chicken person, or even a Kaffir chicken like Grandpa Chook, was impossible to contemplate. Biting into a delicious golden potato, I shook my head.
"To be a welterweight, you must eat properly, PK. Meat will make you strong. Some mutton, perhaps?" she said coaxingly.
When pressed by my mother to have a second helping, my grandpa used to say,
"A cow has 8 stomachs, but I, alas, have 1. A cow must keep on chewing, but I, my dear, am done."
I swallowed the potato and recited this to Big Hetty. It was bound, I felt, to cheer her up. Instead, she started to cry again.
"I'm sorry, Mevrouw Hetty, I'm very sorry, I didn't mean to make you cry again. It is only a silly thing my grandpa says to my ma, just to tease her."
Big Hetty sniffed, blew her nose and wiped her eyes. A piece of chocolate icing from the cloth smeared on the bridge of her nose.
"It is not you, Liefling. It's old Hetty. She is the one I'm crying for."
She smiled weakly through the tears.
"What the hell, PK? What do you say?" she sniffed. "Might as well die eating or starving. Pass me that leg of mutton, my good man."
I handed her the leg of mutton, one half of which had been sliced away almost to the bone. Resting the big end on her chest, she commenced to happily tear away at the meat on the bone, while I demolished a large sweet potato and a mango. When she had finished, the bone had been picked almost clean. To my surprise, she asked me to tear up one of the chickens and place the pieces on her stomach, also to put the slices of corned beef with it. She tore at the chicken as though she was starving, even crunching some of the softer bones. The chicken and the corned beef were soon demolished, and with a soft sigh she wiped the grease and sweat from her face. Using the cake tin, I gathered up the chicken bones scattered over the area of her stomach and tipped them out of the window. I then washed the mango from my face and hands and set to work soaking and squeezing out the only remaining towel. This I handed to Big Hetty and retrieved the old one, which I washed with a bit of soap, rinsed, and hung over the compartment windowsill to dry. I had seen Dum and Dee, our kitchen maids, do the same thing with the wiping up cloths at home after dinner, so I knew I was doing it right. Only they used to hang the cloths from a small line at the side of the big black wood stove, so the dry cloths always smelt a little of soup. Big Hetty put the new cloth, wet as it was, over the front of her dress.
"It's so nice and cool, and the heat of my body will soon dry it," she said,
but I knew it was an attempt to hide the chocolate and grease stains. I thought about having to wash Big Hetty's dress. It would take all day, and would need a basin as big as a small dam. There was a sudden rattle as the compartment door slid open and Henny Fenter appeared.
"I'm sorry I've been so long, Hetty, but Big Porter says he can't walk and is sulking in the guard van. And I've had to do conductor duty because Van Leerman the guard is drunk again. But also I've had to serve lunch," he finished in an apologetic voice.
"What's for lunch?"
Big Hetty asked. Henny seemed surprised at the question.
"Beef stew and mashed potato and peas, like always."
"Keep it. The boy and me would rather starve than eat that pig's swill," she said haughtily.
"Banana custard for pudding today," Henny said enticingly.
"It tastes like what comes out of a baby's bum,"
Big Hetty said scornfully.
"Well, if you don't want any help, I'll kick the dust."
Henny looked over at the open hamper and winked at me.
"I'm sorry you two decided to starve. Are you sure there's nothing I can do for you?"
"You can get me off this bloody floor, man,"
Hetty said in a forlorn voice. The waiter clicked his tongue sympathetically.
"Soon, Hetty. We get the carp maiden in 2 hours. There they will know what to do."
Hoppy had explained to me that from Carpmaiden I would have to take the branch line to Barberton, a further 3 hours' journey,
"in a real little coffee pot," he had said.
He had told me the story of a washerwoman with a huge pile of freshly ironed washing on her head, who was walking along the railway line when the Barberton train drew up beside her. The driver had leant out of the train and invited her to jump aboard into the Kaffir carriage.
"No, thank you, boss,"
she had replied.
"Today I'm in a terrible big hurry."
It was a funny story when Hoppy told it, but I knew it wasn't true because no white train driver would ever think to offer a Kaffir woman a ride on his train.